This is the takeaway for Wednesday, January 4th, 2017. Remember, keep the conversation going on our Facebook page.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The days of Obamacare seem to be numbered.
Have to repeal the budget-busting bills like Obamacare.
Oppose the individual mandate. Oppose Obamacare.
To repeal Obamacare.
But Obamacare was off the charts, was wrong.
I don't like the Obamacare plan.
Repeal whatever is left of Obamacare.
Repeal every single word of Obamacare.
Why do you continue to support a Nazi policy as Obama has?
You know, Obamacare is really, I think, the worst thing that has happened in this nation since slavery.
Setting suns before they fall. Echo to you, that's all, that's all.
Remember all those nasty threats, those chants, long-standing threats from politicians and well-meaning Americans who have been dead set against what, under President Obama, became the law of the land back in 2010?
Today, health insurance reform becomes law in the United States of America.
Obamacare was confirmed in large part by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 2012.
The health care was for me. The health care was for every American family.
Yes, the Affordable Care Act will now become a footnote in the history of health care policy in America. Aside from the feeling we may have that this might not be the most efficient way to do things, enact a landmark piece of legislation and then unenact it, this is no longer an idle political threat, though. It's become the blueprint for another approach to health care and not a return to nothing at all, which was basically the case for 16% of Americans found to be uninsured back in 2009. Today, that number is 11%. 20 million Americans, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, have found insurance under what will soon be no longer the law of the land. Not all of them are happy or enthusiastic about Obamacare or the future without it.
My name is Dana Thielen. I live in Evanston, Illinois. I have benefited from the Affordable Care Act because I do not have employer-provided health insurance, along with many others in America. And so it is in my best interest that the Affordable Care Act is not cut. It would be fantastic if, as a registered nurse, the Affordable Care Act required my job to provide benefit options or benefits at all. I am seriously an uninsured registered nurse. How's that for irony? Katie, Little Rock, Arkansas.
My name is Julie, and I'm calling from Monk's Corner, South Carolina. I have no insurance, but I would have gotten Obamacare if it was just on my income. Instead, they combined it with my husband's higher income, making it not affordable to me because I didn't qualify for any subsidies, and it was over $800 a month, so I just did not go with Obamacare, and I do kind of hope they repeal it.
This is Abigail from McKinney, and the Affordable Care Act is working in my favor as I am a full-time student over 26 who has pre-existing conditions.
Lena on Twitter writes, I'm in the minority here, but all the marketplaces, et cetera, the exchanges she's referring to, are actually really easy and pain-free for me to use. Very happy with it all. Happy, worried, feeling ripped off, confused. Jonathan Gruber, he's an economics professor at MIT and one of the architects of Obamacare. I spoke with Jonathan and Renee Landers, law professor at Suffolk University and director of the healthcare law concentration at the school, about the Affordable Care Act and what it means for the future of healthcare. They joined us from our partner station WGBH in Boston to try to explain where we're headed.
I think we need to start with what Obamacare's accomplished, which is it's met its three primary goals. One was to cover uninsured Americans. More than 20 million Americans have gained coverage. The second was to fix a broken non-group insurance market where insurers can now no longer discriminate against the sick. And the third was to start to bend the cost curve. An employer insurance costs are about $3,600 below what they're projected to be. So Obamacare has met its goals substantively. Unfortunately, it's not met its goals politically. It's never really achieved the popularity or success that its supporters would have hoped, and it's been an uphill battle. So I think that we are facing a situation where Republicans are in a box. They're sort of like, as has been said before, they're kind of like the dog that caught the car. On the one hand, they've been saying for years they want to get rid of it. On the other hand, they recognize, really, that it's been very successful, and they don't have a replacement. And I think that's the situation we find ourselves in.
Renee, how would you put this?
So I would say that I would agree with what Jonathan just described as the substantive impact and also the problem with the politics of the situation. And I attribute some of that to the president and to other Democrats who have not been aggressive early on in really selling the benefits of the program and explaining to the American public what the benefits that it's provided to them. The other thing, though, I would say is that it's changed the public expectation about having health insurance, I think, forever. And that's one of the challenges for the Republicans in the repeal effort, because now the public, even though they would say they don't like some of the aspects of Obamacare in its details and the sort of flaws and some of the implementation, but now they do expect that health care will be available to them at an affordable price. And I really don't think it's possible to turn the clock back on that expectation now.
So, Jonathan, is it possible that Republicans will actually stumble ahead and get to a simplified single-payer system? Maybe they'll call it Health Market, you know, 2000, or Health Market 21st Century, and pretend that it's not, you know, socialism. And that's where we will be in 10 years.
No, it's not possible. If you look at the history of healthcare reform, every time we've tried to move forward in healthcare, we've always moved to the right. You know, every single 20 years we try to reform healthcare, it's been more conservative than the past. Republicans are not going to stumble on single payer.
With the caveat that every time we've done this, we've extended Medicare and Medicaid. So, yes, you're right. We've stumbled to the right. But we've also extended these lefty programs from the 60s.
Right. And right now, I don't think that's in the books. I think really it's about playing defense on those programs. I think, quite frankly, for supporters of covering the uninsured, for supporters of rational health policy in America, the best they can hope for is the closest possible approximation to Obamacare, that Republicans end up with something which is, you know, Trump care in name, but Obamacare in substance, because I don't think we can hope it's going to get better. Getting better would involve essentially just going against so many of their principles. I just don't see it happening.
Right. So I think that, you know, Hillary Clinton's approach during the campaign, which obviously she didn't communicate, was this incrementalist kind of approach that Jonathan was talking about, kind of tweaking the problem areas of Obamacare to try to improve them, you know, increasing the subsidies to people on the individual markets, on the exchanges, you know, trying to limit the out-of-pocket costs on, you know, prescription drugs and things like that. So her approach was that incremental, more conservative, one-step-at-a-time kind of approach, but obviously that did not resonate with the public.
What's the legacy here? They repeal Obamacare and there are going to be huge regrets. Emergency rooms will fill up with diabetics once again, and that's where we're going to be, back to square one? Or is there a real improvement that will take place within the political cycle? Jonathan?
I mean, the only thing we know is that we don't know. All we know is that Republicans have made a series of promises which are mutually inconsistent with not destroying everything Obamacare has accomplished. So if they want to try to keep the gains, if Renee's right, and I hope she is, that the standard has changed in America, look, nobody runs ads saying how awful it is, we have to have auto insurance. Okay? If people have come to believe about health insurance like auto insurance, like it's just something you have in America, then Republicans are going to have to break one of the promises they've made. They're either going to have to include some kind of mandatory enrollment mechanism, or have larger subsidies, or bail out the insurers. Something's going to have to happen. Otherwise, we are going to end up back with the broken system we had before Obamacare.
The other problem with repeal that we haven't really talked about, we've you know, correctly focused on the consumer, the patient population, but are the providers, the hospitals, the physicians, because in the former system, to some extent, any kind of charity care, uninsured care, you know, was financed by these hospitals and, you know, the physicians, you know, who provided free care with some subsidies. I'm oversimplifying here. And part of the deal in Obamacare was to cut out whatever the subsidies were in the system for those kinds of providers, on the understanding that more people would have insurance coverage through the Medicaid expansion or the participation of people in the exchanges. And if you eliminate all of it without restoring those payments to providers, it's actually going to harm the infrastructure of the healthcare system, not just make care less accessible for the population.
You know, call me crazy. This feels a little bit like, you know, if we're looking at legacy here, and that's sort of what we're talking about, that Obamacare is something like the Articles of Confederation for healthcare in America. It's frustrating, and it hasn't achieved its goals, and that it will eventually be replaced by a stronger, more centralized system, even if some people politically have to be dragged kicking and screaming to that eventual outcome. Renee?
Well, it is. I've always thought that the Affordable Care Act was one step in the process toward achieving goals of universal coverage and broader access to health care at more reasonable prices. And I think that the problem with politics in America is that the benefits are always oversold. And then when the reality doesn't match the promise, then people get very frustrated and discouraged. And the political system, as I alluded to earlier, doesn't have a lot of patience for, you know, trying to get it right. If you look at the history of the Medicare and Medicaid programs, they weren't perfect right out of the box. Every year, Congress passes thousands of pages of legislation tweaking both of those programs. And that's been the history because, you know, nothing is perfect. You have to see how it operates in reality, and then you can fix the problems as they occur. And that's what's happened over the evolution of Medicare and Medicaid over the years. And that's what needs to happen with the Affordable Care Act as well, if it's going to be successful and if we maintain some kind of commitment to its goals.
Final thoughts on this legacy question, Jonathan?
Yeah, I'm not quite ready to call you crazy, but I'm going to call you aspirational. Basically, I think that it really comes down to the fundamental question Renee raised, which is, has the conversation changed in a way where Republicans are boxed in to not making things much worse? You know, if you'd asked me in October, what I always said was 2012 was the last election that mattered for Obamacare, that it was now the law and it could never go back. I don't know anymore. So I'd like to think that Renee's right and you're right and that this is the Articles of Confederation, we're moving forward, but I'm not as confident as you are because I think that we're just in a politically unprecedented era and we just don't know what's going to happen.
He's one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, economics professor at MIT, Jonathan Gruber. Also with us, Renee Landers, professor of law at Suffolk University and director of the Health Law Concentration at Suffolk. Renee and Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
We don't do a lot of stories about beleaguered CEOs here on The Takeaway, right? I mean, would you agree with that, guys, in the control room? Yeah. But I think the CEOs of America are tweet-weary these days. Tweet-shy. Having received critical tweets from the president-elect on jobs or wasting taxpayer money, suddenly getting a tweet from the president-elect is a rite of passage in the C-suites of America. It goes back to the days of a very famous Democrat, John F. Kennedy, who took on the steel industry with just his verbal outrage right at the beginning of his administration. There was no Twitter back then. And he, what was called, jawboned them to lower prices, calling their move to raise prices irresponsible.
At a time when they could be exploring how more efficiency and better prices could be obtained, a few gigantic corporations have decided to increase prices in ruthless disregard of their public responsibilities.
John F. Kennedy won by force of bully pulpit alone. So when the Ford Motor Company announced on Tuesday that they were scrapping plans to build a new manufacturing plant in Mexico, were they feeling some bully pulpit heat from Trump Tower? The decision comes amid criticism from the Trump administration about jobs going south of the border. Ford says the decision was one of market demand, not political pressure. But joining us is Joe Henricks, Executive Vice President and President of the Americas at the Ford Motor Company. Joe Henricks, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
So have you felt like you're being jawboned by a Republican, not a Democrat this time?
Well, we work with every administration and we look forward to it, but it is a different time. There's no question about that.
Why would a company respond, and I guess Ford is responding to economic realities, but why would any company respond to a president just trying to shame them, I suppose, for lack of a better term, in the absence of any actual legal mandate or mechanism to, go back, move a factory, change prices, that sort of thing?
Well, I think the high-level topic of American manufacturing and American jobs is something that resonates with all of us, including all of us who work in the big companies that are here. You know, we're proud to be an American company. We're the largest manufacturer of vehicles in the U.S. And I think the president-elect is exposing a conversation around how do we make sure we have an environment here where it makes sense to invest here, and it's a good business. And we expect to see some pro-growth and pro-business type actions by the administration and new Congress to help support that.
Do you have now in your communications department there at Ford a tweet watch department?
I don't think we yet, but we may have to. I was watching the news this morning and another tweet came across about Ford congratulating us on the news yesterday. And So we're going to have to pay attention to that, no question.
Is it something in the address, the mode of style of address of Donald Trump that is compelling from your perspective? I mean, if Obama had asked the same sort of thing, would he have gotten the same kind of result? And again, you said your changes were a result of economic circumstances.
Well, the decisions that we made and announced yesterday, you know, we did for the business. We obviously take into consideration, as I noted, what we expect from policies from the government. But we did that based on what we forecast for demand for volumes and what it meant for small cars. Clearly, you have to take into consideration policy. I mean, in an industry like ours, government policy, everything around interest rates, but also taxation has an effect on our business. And we want to take that into account.
Senior Executive Joe Hendricks is president of the Americas for the Ford Motor Company. He spoke to us from Detroit. Getting back to your conversation about health care and the Affordable Care Act, how could the law be changed to work better for you? That's what we're asking.
My name's Stephanie, and I'm calling from Fort Worth. In my opinion, the insurance companies are taking advantage of the law, providing for sub-quality care by not timely paying the service providers and causing the provider to bail from the plan. This leaves the underserved without quality care, and especially in Texas. Most specifically, in the news, Blue Cross Blue Shield has been identified as being a big, big problem with this.
This is Kate. I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I am a beneficiary of the expansion of Medicaid. I work and raise two kids on my own, and my employer keeps my hours just under the legal limit, so they don't have to offer me health care. This is the first time I've had health care in 8 years. I need the Medicaid expansion to stay in the program. I need that part of Obamacare. It's vital for so many of us.
A lot of you are tweeting us about the Affordable Care Act. Jennifer Greenwell says the ACA would like to see transparency for medical costs. Knowing how much my care will cost is integral to my financial stability, and the ACA's transparency will undoubtedly have another incarnation, depending on what happens with the Republicans and Democrats. Dave says, I get fined annually, not health care. Single payer is the only option.
Aaron Tate, Dallas, Texas. We joined Obamacare as it was mandatory and started out at lower rates, kept increasing year-round, until this year, as it was astronomical prices and would not cover my wife's doctors. So we looked some more and found private insurance, which would. It was $50 more. Wah, wah.
We get our insurance policy through the ACA, and I just wish we could use Medicare for All with a private plan to supplement services. I see private facilities and even hospitals devoting so much personnel and resources to just managing insurance claims. That seems so wasteful. Imagine the savings if this wasn't the issue. And let's not forget the doctor's lobby that seeks to keep their fees high regardless of the cost to patients. This is Susan Hess-Loger in Portland, Oregon.
Anoka, Minnesota says, without the health care I have signed up for through the marketplace, I'd be paying over half my income for minimal coverage through my employer.
This is Leanne from Pena, Illinois. My family doesn't get health coverage through the exchanges. Our pre-ACA policy grandfathered in, but it was affected because it now covers wellness checks, vaccines, and pre-existing conditions. However, our premium went up $300 per month this year. We pay $1,100 monthly for six people with a $7,000 deductible. We do not qualify for a subsidy. The Affordable Care Act misses the mark because premiums are too high and drug costs are out of control. $1,300 is the list price for 30 acne pills. Healthcare is such a huge financial industry that it will be very difficult to cut into the profits they now enjoy. It walks and quacks like price gouging.
Thanks for your thoughtful responses. We'd love to know your experience with Obamacare. Let's talk to us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or just email us at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. As we've been reporting, violence in Chicago in 2016 reached levels not seen since the late 1990s. And so far, the trend continues in 2017, with the Chicago Tribune reporting more than 40 shooting victims in just the first 3 days in the new year. Takeaway member station WBEZ in Chicago has been featuring remarkable stories and voices from community members who remember the bad old days of 1998, even as they are experiencing today's violence.
Our installment today comes from the perspective of former gang member Edwin Day, who experienced violence as the defining quality of his life until he decided not to let it define him.
After my mom passed, we ended up moving into my grandparents' home. It was my four siblings and my dad. We kind of shared a bedroom, and there was a lot of dysfunction in the home. I had a cousin that was my age, and he was involved in gangs and different things. And so this is the thing that I'm seeing a lot. And so I just kind of started off just kind of hanging out for a while, and eventually it ended up turning into being involved with drugs. We were selling crack and heroin. And so what ended up happening, we was involved in the gang war. We were going back and forth, you know, they would come and shoot at us and, you know, try to kill us. And we would kind of go back and do the same thing to those guys. You think about your firing and you kind of, you know, from a street ethics aspect, you feel that what you're doing is noble. You know, this is my guys, this is my crew, this is who I'm with, and so we're going to defend us and ours at all costs. August of 97, I mean, it's the height of the summer's hot, everyone's out. And so as I was leaving the home, unbeknown to myself, there was a guy waiting in the bushes, and he began to shoot. And so as I'm running across the street, he begins to let off the other shot. It might have been 13 shots. Pop, pop, pop. And so as I'm running, I catch the first one in the back of my leg. You know, I ended up making it across the street. But by the time I got over there, I had caught so many shots, I just kind of collapsed right there. After I was completely healed, I ended up going back to that same community. And it wasn't until I was arrested for being involved selling drugs. And that's when I ended up going to prison for about 11 months. And it was then that I made a decision that this wasn't the life for me. When you think about 98, you're talking about crack, and it was chaos. But I think now you have young people who have found themselves subject to hopelessness. Hopelessness mixed with different types of mind-altering drugs, mixed with assault rifles and crazy amounts of weaponry. And so with the height of violence that's going on all over Chicago, we wanted to be that positive light. My wife and I started an organization called Dreams Incorporated, working with at-risk youth, young people. It's not even about giving them things. You know, I think more important is really just being an ear, a listening ear, and having a heart that cares. They don't see a lot of people that even care about them. The thing that we can do, we want to walk with you. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? We don't want to give you nothing. We're just going to go sit down. Let's go to lunch. And so those small things are the things that the kid values, because whether they listen today, once they get finished ripping and running and doing all of the different things that they do, they're going to think about, oh, Mr. Day, I was sent with Mr. Day. Mr. Day really care.
Edwin Day's story comes to us courtesy of WBEZ reporter Patrick Smith. At age 17, young Sitawa Wafula of Kenya was diagnosed with both epilepsy and bipolar disorder. Having a mental illness in her country is seen as a spiritual taboo. And in Sitawa's harrowing and lonely experience, she decided to stop waiting for a doctor to come to her and to instead take matters into her own hands. Sitawa lost a job because she had a seizure. She had to drop out of university after being raped. With no support system, Sitawa started blogging about her daily challenges. In 2014, she won $25,000 from the Google Africa competition for her work and used the money to start My Mind, My Funk, Kenya's first free mental health support line. The helpline receives about 25,000 text messages a year, helping about 11,000 people. Sitawa knows how tough it can be for fellow Kenyans to open up about their struggles, but she remembers how emotionally rewarding it was to get her feelings out in the open in a journal before launching her blog.
One of the things I always say, and I still say today, having a blank piece of paper is like a new lease of life. It's like today, regardless of all the things that you're fighting in your head or in your life, this is a new lease of life. Pour on it what struggles you have. Pour on it what sort of day you want to have today.
And what are they most concerned with without revealing any confidences?
Most of the ones I've been getting are about people feeling depressed, going through depression, people feeling some sense of hopelessness or some sort of pressure in terms of they should have achieved something or gone this far, but they don't feel that they've been able to achieve that.
Is it men or women mostly who contact you?
Surprisingly, I get more emails from men. It sort of looks like it's easier for women to walk up and say, this is what I'm going through. We've just been trying to dig deeper into that and just seeing it's more of a social constraint where men are unfortunately supposed to come across in a certain way. So they're supposed to be macho. They're supposed to be in control. When someone is going through depression, we tell them, unfortunately, man up. That means you need to be standing on your own 2 feet. You're not supposed to be crying or weak or complaining about things. So for them, it's much easier to write it down than to walk up to people and say, hey, I'm struggling with this and that.
In all of your work over these years, since you started the blog and now the success of the Google Award and the support line, what infrastructure, what programs do you need to back you up?
It's not necessarily one thing, because the issues that people with mental health conditions face come from different places. So number one would definitely be awareness creation, which hopefully will reduce the stigma and discrimination that people face, and also hopefully encourage more people to come forth and look for support. So once more people are coming forth for support, the second thing would definitely be affordable and accessible mental health services. And then from a government point of view, we need implementation of the mental health policies.
How does the success of your hotline make it hard for you to have a personal life of your own?
Initially, it was a little bit hard because then I was trying to think, oh, the first thing people will think about when they see me is someone who has epilepsy and she might fall. But then with time, it's made it easier for me to be in spaces I want to be in because people already know. So then I don't need to pretend or act a certain way or not do certain things because I'm afraid of what people will say or what they'll think about me. What I'm working on right now is more from a personal point of view of dividing the two and drawing the line and make it very clear that my work life ends here and my personal life, which is more or less me being in my own space and just doing a lot of my artwork, starts here.
All right. Well, good luck finding that balance. And I hope that 2017 is a great year for you, Satawa.
Thank you very much.
Satawa Wafula is the founder of My Mind, My Funk, Kenya's first free mental health hotline.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Among his other messages over the holidays, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted, "The United Nations has such great potential, but right now it is just a club for people to get together, talk, and have a good time. So sad." The tweet came as the UN Security Council voted on a resolution condemning Israel and its settlements. That position, the future American president vehemently disagrees with. The vote came after many years of seeking a two-state solution in the Arab-Israeli conflict. That two-state solution is now in doubt. But how frustrating is the experience at the United Nations these days, with the war in Syria raging, a famine in Yemen caused by a Saudi-led war condemned by the UN, ignored by the Saudis and the U.S. for that matter? These are challenging days for the new Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, who began his term earlier this week. As an outgoing UN official just a few days ago at the end of 2016, I spoke with Deputy Secretary of the UN Jan Eliasson about some of the frustrations and challenges ahead for 2017.
We now face in this world resources that are getting more and more scarce. And there are two ways to deal with scarce resources. And I think the most important, the sacred one, in fact, is water. And either you choose the road of competition, rivalry, even conflict and war to have the water resources, or you choose the road of cooperation, the road of sharing, the road of confidence building by sharing resources. So water can either be a great source of conflict, but if we do it right, it could be a source of peace. This is a historic situation in which we find ourselves. I've served in Darfur. I was mediating in the conflict in Darfur, and I saw how the militia had thrown a dead dog in a well in order to chase the population into the camps, away from the village. But who was helped by this? Nobody could take over this village. We see also rivers across borders where one side needs energy and the other one needs agriculture. They have to work out ways of sharing water resources. So I think this is one of the key areas. It's really sort of the canary in the coal mine. The water issue is a sort of a miniature of the greater challenges related to climate change.
Would you say that the United Nations in 2017 is going to face a particular crisis, or that it's going to be facing all of what we've been speaking about in a more urgent and serious way?
Well, the most urgent crisis to deal with is, of course, ending the war in Syria and also realizing that there is no military victory in Syria, but that there has to be a cessation of hostilities, there has to be humanitarian access to all in Syria, and then there has to be the beginning of political talks, a political process. But then we cannot look away, shy away from the existential threats, the long-term threats that stem from climate change and extreme poverty. And then there is something else that I fear very much, and that is the trend in today's world to divide our nations in ethnic or religious or tribal groups and identify those outside or those in the minority as being the problem. We have to deal with this trend of xenophobia and make sure that we come to the conclusion that most of our nation states, whether they're large or small, build on the strength of diversity, and that we should accept every human being's equal worth and value. That, I think, is something United Nations, which is a value-driven organization, always must stand for and translate to concrete action on the ground. But that is basically a question for member states and the people in our nation states to stand up for these values.
I mean, that's what's so frustrating about the Syrian civil war. The war seems to be immune to any kind of peacekeeping. The Security Council seems to have no role in changing the conflict. It's at the center of a refugee crisis, which is on a scale exceeding that at the end of World War II. And right now, the United Nations seems powerless to deal with both the Syrian civil war and this refugee crisis.
Well, I've followed this conflict for the last almost 5 years. And I can say to you that this has become such a horribly difficult problem because we haven't dealt with it early on. If there had been a chance to present Kofi Annan's proposals of 2012 in the Security Council, reach a binding Security Council resolution, we would have had a different situation now. At that time, 2012, ISIS, Daesh, did not even exist. Today, we have a situation where peace is so elusive because we need to have agreement on the highest level between particularly United States and Russia. You need to have agreement in the region that they want to end this fighting, agreement between Saudi Arabia, Iran, Qatar, and Turkey. And then, of course, as you know, the opposition in Syria is highly divided and also interspersed with terrorist elements. So the situation has become so much more difficult by the time that has passed. So the lesson to be learned is that prevention must be the key priority for the UN, and that's the direction we have to go if we are to be in control of the present crisis in the world.
Finally, as you leave office and leave your tenure with all your long experience as a diplomat, how personally frustrating is it that you're walking away from a conflict where you've had almost no influence or very, very little influence? How difficult is that?
No, it has been difficult, but you have to sort of come to the conclusion that, like life in general, you have ups and downs and you have successes, you have failures, and you must not be depressed by the failures. It's part of the job. It's like Sisyphus moving the stone up the hill. You know, you get it back in the face every now and then. But I say, as Martin Luther, even if the world would go under tomorrow, I would plant my apple tree today. We simply have to mobilize the good forces and try to have a narrative out in the world that we need international cooperation, we need solidarity, we need to maintain the beauty of diversity in our societies, and that's what we have to stand for, as again, as a value-driven organization.
Jan Eliasson, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Jan Eliasson is a Swedish diplomat and now the former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations. I spoke with him just before he left his post at the end of last year. Imagine fighting the terrorist bloodshed in Baghdad with just a little stick, a stick strung with horsehair on a street strewn with rubble. Captured here in a cell phone video, which you can find on YouTube, you can see a bombed out building, emergency workers, you can hear sirens and traffic in the background. Crowds gather, and there, as a man in a wheelchair rolls up, they all are seen to be listening to a man playing his cello. The man is Karim Wasfi. His solo concert echoes the famous cello solos of Mstislav Rostropovich at the Berlin Wall. The concerts of Pablo Casals during the Spanish Civil War between the fascists and the Republic back in the 1930s. In addition to being a renowned cellist, Wasfi is also the conductor of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. He's become a symbol of the everyday resistance to the violence that has gripped the country for more than a decade. He embodies the power of local action, shedding the powerlessness of waiting for leaders and armies to protect the people he loves, and instead taking actions himself. This is something we've committed ourselves to paying attention to on The Takeaway. And Wasfi came to our studios when he was in New York recently to accept the Asia Society's Asia Game Changers Award to spread the good news of how music and art can be weapons for peace.
I was conducting the clarinet concerto in a rehearsal where one-third of the orchestra made it to the rehearsal venue. Amidst all that, I had to convince musicians that let's try and gather at least twice a week and create something and then document it somehow, archive it for the history. If something happens to us, at least we tried. So here I'm conducting the rehearsal for the clarinet concerto. We reach the second movement, and all of a sudden, we are invaded by the smell of dead bodies from the morgue. Because of the fierce fighting, there were no services for a couple of days, and the morgue had no power anymore, and there was a pile of dead people in that morgue across from that venue. Then, don't ask me how, but I could see the smell. Not only smell it, I could see the impact of that around us in this strange moment of certainty, not uncertainty. I decided to fight back and convince everyone, even on a personal level, to try and stay and do something that is proactive versus just waiting for destiny or fate to change what we are about.
Your moment in the rubble, of course, is an echo of the 1989 Rostropovich playing the cello at the Berlin Wall. It's many other things as well. What is the role of music in the rubble of our time?
Challenging instability and terror through refinement, overcoming actually the impact of terror and extremism through refinement, cultivation, and civilization, civility. And respecting, appreciating, recognizing beauty, I think, is one of the most important elements of that.
In the time of World War II, Shostakovich, you know, was writing symphonies about the siege of Leningrad and about the wretched disappointments of the Stalinist period when communism's promises were you know, seen to be lies. Will there be a symphony about the retaking of Mosul? I get the sense that it's not the focus of art right now, that Iraq's troubles are off the radar.
Thank you for being very direct about that and very adequate in explaining. Yes, there will be. I was actually, 48 hours ago, I was in a challenge with one of the officers over there because I was so persistent about going to Mosul with my cello, with my 300 years old Italian instrument. But there are so many different uncertainties in Iraq, and there are so many different priorities, to the extent that to do something like that, you just have to be proactive, to include the impromptu performances I was giving at the car bomb sites. But yes, there will be something about Mosul. The difference to great Rostropovich was, I think there was a positive outcome after the Berlin Wall was demolished, compared to the continued instability in the regional, in the Middle East and in Iraq, which is very unfortunate. And the only way to overcome that, in my perspective, was to be proactive, dedicated, and determined that humanity will win.
It would seem that you and Gustavo Dudamel are brothers in the sense of having homes that are in trouble and terrible instability. I mean, he said that music is a fundamental human right, and he performs as the conductor in Los Angeles, concerned about what might happen every night in Venezuela.
That's exactly how I feel.
How do you, as an artist, what is your responsibility? Your audiences are, you know, maybe very well-to-do people who have no cares about such things, but yet your heart burns.
Yes, because it's a responsibility, it's a moral obligation, it's a human obligation to be able to overcome ugliness and uncertainty through something that is very certain, which is the power of music, that is so relevant to creation, that is so relevant to being who we are as creatures, as human beings, that is relative to also how do we interact with our own self and with others. And it's also relevant to refinement again. And I emphasize refinement because we can see clearly now what civilization does and what ignorance does in terms of politicized approach to life, which is extremism, wars, instability, and so forth. But also, on the other hand, the impact of knowledge and awareness and compassion and consciousness, which are all clearly affected positively through art and music. I have these worries. Nothing is certain anymore. Our lives are all improvisational. We try to plan. We try to have obligations. We try to arrange and plan our lives. But really, what is certain? Partially, what makes our lives certain is how we can share beauty and how we can inspire and how we can overcome, not only battle and fight, overcome greed and envy and the ugliness of extremism and terror through good doing and through refinement, which can all be, even at the grassroots level, it can all be achievable through music.
You want to choose a, just based on this conversation, what music should we play?
Brahms Fourth.
Brahms Fourth?
Yeah.
We'll do that. Karim Wasfi, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Karim Wasfi is the conductor of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. DJing impulse there from Wasfi. And as we listen to Brahms, here's something to take with you today. It's kind of sad, I'm afraid. The oldest known orca whale is missing and believed to be no longer with us. Granny, who normally swims in Puget Sound in the Pacific Northwest, was thought to be about 106 years old. As I said, she's now missing somewhere in those Pacific waters up near Seattle and Vancouver. We'd love to hear from you. Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We want to be a part of any of your conversations. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
It's a support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.